You're listening to Democracy Optimist, a special election year series from Eastern Standard, WEKU, and Dynamics Productions. Our host, University of Kentucky election law and voting research professor, Josh Douglas.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law, with a dose of hope sprinkled in. Today, we are delighted to speak with Amber McReynolds, who is the vice chair of the United States Postal Service Board of Governors, which is a Senate-confirmed position, where she focuses on the Postal Service's processing of mail-in ballots. Basically, she's the person who guarantees that millions of ballots are processed correctly through the mails. Amber, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So, wow, millions of ballots going through the mails. That's got to be a logistical nightmare from, you know, all the states having to get both to the voters and then back to the election officials, especially because some states conduct their elections entirely via the mail. What's the biggest challenge?
Well, first and foremost, I, as you mentioned, I'm the vice chair of the Board of Governors. So that's the oversight aspect of the Postal Service, just like a Fortune 50 board of directors. I have a board role. I chair the election mail committee, but the management team and the team is really who handles all of the aspects of election mail going through the Postal Service. And we've done a couple of things actually since 2020. So first at the governor level, which is I'm one of the governors, we've established a permanent election mail and government mail committee that takes a look at these all of these issues surrounding election and government mail and monitors that. Then we've also, the management team actually internally restructured the election mail team to add more resources, add more oversight, add more accountability, all within the realm of election and government mail. And that's really important and key to making sure communication is streamlined to our massive operation nationwide. And a couple things about the Postal Service. So first, we have about 640,000 employees. We have over 32,000 locations. We're the only entity, business, government, any, that serve every single constituent, citizen, household, business, as well as every voter, as well as every election office, almost every day of the year. So it's a massive operation, to say the least. And we have a touch point in every community in the United States of America. So that's why, you know, not only for mail ballots, as you mentioned, but all election material, polling place assignment cards, voter registration letters, election materials broadly, all of that goes through the postal system to reach voters. So there's a huge impact, a huge process that happens. Just to give you a sense of the numbers, on a daily basis, we deliver over 400 million pieces of mail a day to 173 million doors. So the capacity is massive. The ability of the Postal Service is massive. Our carriers are on the front lines delivering to all those doors every day. And we take this seriously. And that's, you know, that's why I think it's an important highlight that you're doing here in terms of the work that goes into putting on a big election.
That's really amazing. It's sort of mind-boggling to think about the number of pieces of mail that have to make it through the system to have a successful election. Walk us through the actual process of a ballot within the Postal Service. You know, so I request for my county clerk that I want to vote absentee, some states call it. Some states, you know, just mail-in ballot. I request that. What happens next from your all's process?
Well, so first and foremost, I mean, the Postal Service, just like every piece of mail we deliver mail that's brought to us. And those policies are determined at the state level, at each state level. And then the federal government obviously has roles when it comes to what mailings go out. Help America Vote Act, MVRA, a number of federal laws have dictated what happens. So we're not involved in the policy making process around that. We accept mail from jurisdictions that are utilizing our services to support the election process. So states that are, for instance, they mail a ballot proactively to everyone, they have various security measures ahead of that mailing that determine, for instance, check a change of address. They might have automatic or automated voter registration to make sure the addresses are most up to date. States like Colorado have that process in place and have for a long time. And then the other states that where you're required to request a mail ballot, you have to sign up for that either before each election, each year, or on a permanent basis, like what Arizona has. But in that instance, you're interacting with the election official, telling them where to send your requested mail-in ballot. The election officials are validating that you're a registered voter, that you're active, meaning you haven't moved or your address has not changed. They're also checking to make sure that the voter is, like I said, an eligible voter. So if a voter, for instance, that pre-registered to vote at 16 signed up for a mail ballot, they're not 18 yet, they might not be eligible to get that if they did request it. There's all these eligibility checks that go into the process on the election official side of things. And that varies by state, varies by jurisdiction. It depends on what the state laws are in that place. And then election officials go through a period of time where they certify the ballot content about 60 days out, usually from every election day. And that's where they're determining what that ballot will look like, what information will appear on that ballot for the voter. And then they go into a process of preparing that for printing, preparing it for printing. They usually, a lot of election offices do that in-house where they'll print and mail everything manually. A lot of the larger jurisdictions in some states, they use a vendor to help them print all of that material. And those vendors are certified either at the state level or in conjunction with a professional process. And then the election officials will send a file of either requested ballots, people that have signed up to request it, if that's what their state law is, or in a state where it's proactive, they'll send that list of eligible voters that are set to receive and be mailed their ballot. The printer prepares all that material. A lot of states now are using intelligent mail barcode tracking, which provides accountability through the entire process. They'll spray that barcode information on the outside of the envelope. All of that printing and processing happens, and the ballots are then prepared for mailing. And then after all of that, they get dropped with the Postal Service, usually in some sort of pre-sort method to leverage the best practices and also the best rates for mailing. And then it comes to us, and we scan it through our various processing facilities. We're scanning that intelligent mail barcode as that's been sprayed on there so that voters can see where their mail ballot is at every step in the process. And then our carriers get it, and it gets delivered out to the house. And then the reverse of that happens if the voter chooses for the ballot to be mailed back to us. And I will say states vary on this note too, as you can imagine. Some states pay pre-postage and they handle that on their end. Other states, the voter has to affix postage. And so it just depends on what a state chooses to do in terms of policy on that.
Yeah, what happens if you're in a state that requires the voter to put the postage on and the person delivers their ballot without a stamp?
So the policy and the process has been, and we work, as I said, we've got a whole team of people that work directly with election officials around the country to work out with them what their processes are around these issues. But when a voter doesn't affix the proper postage, that actually gets billed to the election office. So the ballot will still get delivered back to the election official, but the election official will pick up essentially and cover the remainder of the postage that's not affixed on there. So, you know, for voters, it's far easier if the postage is prepaid, just so they don't have to, you know, worry about that. But most states still require the voter to affix postage. And usually that will appear in the instruction sheet that the voter receives in the mail.
But, you know, just dispelling one myth that I hear from people, the ballot will still get delivered, even though you should put postage on. That's the state requirement. You know, votes are not going uncounted because of that. So here's the big question. You answered this a little bit already, I think, but just to dive kind of directly at it. The big question many people have and the resistance to more widespread vote by mail policies, this is concern about fraud. So can you address why fraud is not a major concern, even with millions of ballots being processed via the Postal Service?
Yeah, well, so first, it's really about a lot of the checks and balances that happen before the ballots are ever mailed. And, you know, with a process of, you know, in essence, when we are when election officials, and I say we because I'm part of this community or was, when a ballot is mailed out, it has already gone through various checks and balances that actually don't happen when it don't always happen in the same way with regards to in-person voting. And what I mean by that is for a ballot to get to the voter at the correct address and for them to be able to vote that ballot, we have to know, the election officials have to know where that voter is. They have to have the correct address on file. They have to have that correct information. They're determining eligibility before that ballot is ever mailed out. So if you're inactive or you haven't updated your address in a while or you haven't engaged with the election office, you're not going to be able to get that in the mail until you actually take action, until you contact your election official. So they're only going out to active voters, first and foremost. They're only going out, and this is after various checks and balances happen, but automated things like national change of address check or checks against motor vehicle database, especially in states that leverage the ERIC system, which is a cross-state check of when voters move around the country. All of that is happening before that ballot packet is ever mailed to voters. And I think that's an important piece that often gets overlooked. You sort of hear politicians say, oh, they're just being mailed out. And actually, that's not the case. There's a lot of steps that go in to play before that ballot is ever put in the mail stream. Postal Service is delivering what it's, you know, what we are given, just like all the other mail that we are, that people pay us to deliver. We don't necessarily have anything to do with that check that election officials go through. And the other thing I would say is ballots are not forwardable. So like a lot of pieces of mail can be forwarded to a new address if the voter moves, ballots cannot be forwarded. So if that voter is no longer at that address, that ballot will actually come back to the election official and the voter has to take action to tell the election official where their new address is before that ballot is mailed out.
I feel like every year we hear these anecdotes of, you know, oh, I received a ballot from, you know, someone who lived at this residence 10 years ago. You know, sometimes these things go viral on social media. How do we respond to that, both, you know, the fact that it sometimes happens and the misinformation that goes around with it?
Yeah, look, those instances are very, very tiny. Often it's probably, it could be that a state is not part of, for instance, a cross state like an ERIC system where they're checking to see when people move around the country. A lot of times when I've seen this happen, states that don't have automated voter registration. So like when you go to the motor vehicle office and you update your address, if that process isn't automated, the election official won't receive that information that the voter has moved. So when we actually see those instances, I always ask the question of, well, what are the other policies in place that are in that state? When was the last time this voter engaged with the election office? When did they last provide that address? It's exceedingly rare that that happens. But usually it's related to another policy, not related to the actual process of requesting a mail ballot. It usually has to do with something else. And I, you know, I've seen mistakes like that. I've also seen where someone moves out, especially of an apartment complex or high mobility areas, and they've done that within 30 days of an election. Well, if a state has a 30-day cutoff for registration issues and they can no longer update addresses after that 30 days and a voter moves away, of course that ballot is going to arrive if the election official is prevented, which is the case in a lot of states with really long voter registration deadlines, if they're prevented from updating that record. And those are the instances we see. It's very rare, but those instances happen in very rare cases. But at the same time, even when that arrived to the wrong location, the other thing we haven't talked about yet, I talked about all the front end processing and steps and accountability and security measures that are in place. Then there's all the back end, including signature verification checks, the affidavit that gets signed by the voters. In some states, you have to provide either the last four of your social or your driver's license number or even a copy of that, depending on what your voter registration status is. So there's a lot of verification that goes in on the back end. And so when you actually look at the whole process, mail ballots have far more steps of validation and accountability than other methods of voting that we see in the election process.
Yeah, and it demonstrates how the Postal Service process interacts so much with state law on these issues as well. Now, Amber, you've done so many things with respect to elections. You know, you were the director of elections in Denver. You ran the organization National Vote at Home Coalition, which advocates for expanded vote-by-mail policies. Now you're with the Postal Service. You wrote a book in 2020 titled When Women Vote that focuses on the stories of the struggles of women in particular that are faced in voting and the reform efforts to make voting easier for all. Given all of that and also the struggles of 2020 and the doom and gloom we hear about 2024, are you optimistic about voting in elections going into this election year?
So here's a few things. I started and helped start the nonprofit National Vote at Home. I haven't been there since 2021, so I just wanted to clarify that. But I've worked on all of these issues, whether it be technology and innovation, security and accessibility, expanding the franchise and access. One of the other very important issues to me is, and I've been an unaffiliated voter my whole career. Unaffiliated voters are now the biggest voting bloc. Independent voters are the biggest voting bloc in the country, and they're still largely left out of primaries. And I've been certainly working on a lot of those issues. I've worked across the spectrum on all nonpartisan related issues to really just to enfranchise voters to be able to use their voices and participate and engage, because I actually believe that the easier it is for voters to engage, obviously balancing security measures and accountability and all those things we have in place, but the easier it is for voters to engage and let their voices be heard, the higher trust they're going to have in the process, the higher trust they're going to have in the government that represents them. And so I think it's absolutely crucial that we ensure all voters can access the process. There's two things I would say about the 2024 cycle. First, I'm highly optimistic about the amazing election officials that are on the front lines of democracy. They have withstood attacks, threats to their lives, harassment, even systematic attacks, meaning they keep getting inundated with kind of bogus public records requests that are really just in an effort to distract them from doing their jobs. But these folks have been serving on the front lines. They've withstood incredible adversity with regards to this process. And they give me a ton of hope. And I hope everyone, you know, who's listening, I would encourage people to serve as a poll worker, sign up to be an election judge, call your county clerk or your registrar of voters, or your supervisor of elections. They're all called different things in different states, but call them and ask how you can help as a citizen. It could be getting the word out. It could be serving as an election judge. But these people give me incredible hope. And a lot of them are my dear friends, but they are on the front lines of our democracy and they're serving every day in the great face of a lot of adversity that's been thrown at them and often underfunded, I should say. The second group of people, I continue to be optimistic about the American voter. I have tremendous optimism for the voters of this country to make their voices heard, make choices that reflect the representation that they want to see in their government. And I would encourage all voters to continue to engage. I know it can be frustrating. I know it can feel overwhelming. I know it can feel frustrating to continue to see the sort of political fight always in DC without much happening. But I think it's so important that people continue to engage, and I have great optimism that voters will do that again. I will say that I am deeply concerned about, again, the impact on disinformation, the lack of knowledge generally in not only the public, but I would say actually a lot of the partisan politicians, when they talk about elections, they are often very wrong and they're telling people the wrong information. And so I continue to worry about the impact of bad information on voters, on the election itself. We're not sure how AI is going to impact things yet. We're not sure about some of the other security threats. So there's a number of really big concerns that I have about the election. but also great optimism about the people involved in it.
Well, and I'm optimistic, you know, when we hear about the various checks that are within the system, the checks and balances you mentioned. So thank you for enlightening us with, you know, how mail-in balloting actually works. That's so useful for voters to hear. Amber McReynolds, thanks so much for joining us on Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, what would be your election law of the day?
Well, I'm going to have to talk about election laws because I want to discuss vote by mail and how widespread it is. You know, according to the National Vote at Home Institute, which is this organization that promotes expanded vote by mail opportunities, about one third of all U.S. registered voters live in states or jurisdictions where they either automatically receive a ballot for every election or they had the option to do so via a permanent absentee voting policy. So in a third of the states, and eight states run their elections entirely vote by mail, and they run the gamut from so-called blue states like Oregon and Washington and California to middle-of-the-road states like Colorado to more red states like Utah. Arizona, most voters there are on a permanent absentee balloting list. So they automatically receive a ballot after they've opted in once. And I think there's a lot of promise for expanded vote by mail, as we discussed with Amber. So it's vote by mail in general and the expansion of it. Certainly the 2020 election and the pandemic caused a lot of states to temporarily increase the opportunity to vote by mail. The other interesting thing about this is that sometimes the policy is better known as a vote at home instead of vote by mail because it's actually ballot delivery through the mails, right? The Postal Service is delivering your ballot. But about half of voters actually drop their completed ballots off at a drop box instead of putting it back in the mail again. Where are you voting, though? You're voting at home. And that's why the National Vote at Home Institute prefers the term vote at home.
And I take it those states are seeing improvement in voter participation?
That's what's really interesting is if you look at the states with the highest turnout and you look at what policies they have, there's really two policies that are consistent. One is expanded vote by mail, you know, where states where you don't need an excuse to vote via the mails, where you either are on this permanent list, you only have to request once, or you're just on the list automatically. The second policy is same-day voter registration. About two-thirds of states have same-day voter registration where there's not a deadline before Election Day when you have to get on the voter rolls. And the combination of those two are really best practices in terms of improving voter turnout.
2024 certainly has our rapt attention. We're in a presidential election year, so a lot of conversation going on around that. And it's always fun to have a good nugget in your hip pocket to pull out when you're in one of those conversations. Can you give us a fun election fact?
So in talking to Amber about her book with respect to women's suffrage, I was curious, when have women run for office and run for president? And my research found that the first woman to run for president was in 1872. Victoria Claflin Woodhull ran for president. She was a women's rights activist. She fought for women's suffrage. She was a popular public speaker and a newspaper publisher. She was also the first woman to directly address a congressional committee and the first woman to own a Wall Street investment firm. Alas, her campaign went nowhere, and she wasn't even constitutionally eligible to run for president or to become president because she was not yet 35 years old, which is the constitutional requirement. But Victoria Claflin Woodhull has the distinction of being the first woman to do a lot of things, including run for president in 1872.
You know, there's that saying, you never miss your water till your well runs dry. And the same could be said for democracy. We take it for granted. It's like air in this country. It's part of how we've lived. Yet now we're hearing that it is seriously threatened. Some people say 2024 may be the most consequential year of their lives. What one thing can those of us who are concerned about that do to support democracy?
You know, Tom, there's a reason that we called this show Democracy Optimist, because I want to focus on tangible ways where we can sustain our democracy. And, you know, vote by mail is one because it can make it so much easier for people to participate. I have faith in voters. I have faith that if we have, you know, closer to universal suffrage, then we can have a democracy that will be sustained. The problems are that we have all of these politicians and others trying to make it harder for a lot of people to vote. Universal vote by mail can break down and it has effects on all voters, Democrat, Republican, or what have you. So I encourage listeners to visit the website for the National Vote at Home Coalition. It's www.voteathome.org because they have really great facts. And we talk a lot about understanding what facts are and spreading truthful information. The National Vote at Home Coalition's website has studies, has facts about the power of voting via the mail, has facts about the lack of fraud with respect to vote at home. So one thing to do to support democracy, visit voteathome.org.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU. Educate myself on the fight.